This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time. And soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Have you ever seen something much more clearly with the benefit of hindsight? Well, there's a practice called the Life Review that helps you reassess the events of your life with candor, positive mindset, and with the benefit of your more mature, wiser self. And that can help you craft your next chapters with purpose. For our guest today, a phone call one afternoon with information about the father he never knew was the spark for a life review. William Damon is professor of education at Stanford University and director of the Stanford Center on Adolescence. He is one of the world's leading researchers on lifespan human development, and he's written many influential books, including The Path to Purpose and The Moral Child. He's been elected to the National Academy of Education and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In September 2020, he was named one of the 50 most influential psychologists in the world. His latest book is A Round of Golf with My Father, The New Psychology of Exploring Your Past to Make Peace with the Present. You'll find his full bio in the show notes.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
So I'd like to start with a subject that you've studied for many years, and that's purpose. What's the distinction you make between purpose and meaning?
It's an important question because commonly when people talk about having a life of, quote, meaning and purpose, they put the two together as if it's the same thing. And of course, you don't need more than one word for the same thing in science or in education or in any kind of practice. Every word should have its own particular meaning. And meaning, the word meaning is related to purpose because purposes are always meaningful. They're not, if a purpose is not meaningful, it's not a purpose. If somebody commands you to do something and you don't want to do it or you don't care about it, you can't say that's your purpose. But purpose is more than meaning. It goes beyond meaning. With purpose, you have a goal. You have something you're trying to accomplish. It's a commitment to do something that makes a difference in the world. And even more than that, there's a bit of a beyond the self aspect to purpose, almost like a transcendent quality. If I have a purpose in life, it's something I'm dedicated to that I care about so much because I think it will leave something to the world at large, the world beyond the self. And so the word meaning signifies all kinds of interesting things that you can do. You go to a movie that's meaningful. You can read a poem that's meaningful. All those things are great. Nothing wrong with them. But purpose goes beyond that. Purpose is an effort and an intention to accomplish something that makes a difference in the world beyond the self.
You also note that purpose is something that's often mistakenly portrayed as heroic and something that really is privileged people, essentially. But is purpose available to everyone?
Of course it is. And you're absolutely right that a lot of people are put off by the idea of purpose because they think of Achilles bravely going forth into battle. And of course, there are heroic purposes. But raising a family is a purpose. That's very ordinary. A lot of people raise families and have the purpose of wanting to do right by their children. Every kind of job, the most ordinary, mundane job, can be done purposefully. Isn't always done purposefully, and that's, of course, makes a huge difference. But that's true of people in high-status jobs as well as low-status jobs. They can either be purposeful or not purposeful. And the person that sweeps the streets, if that person is dedicating himself or herself to it and really trying to do a good job and understanding how important it is, that person has every bit as much purpose as the president of the United States or anybody else in society.
And there are times when raising a family seems quite heroic.
That is true. And I can say that because I just spent a long week with my grandson, who totally exhausted me. and ran me around. And of course, it was wonderful, but I would say I was a bit heroic in keeping up with him. So thank you for that.
So often our identity can become intertwined with what we do for work. And when someone moves away from full-time work, how can their identity be reconstructed?
So there is actually an idea in the field at large generated by Mark Friedman, the wonderful expert on aging, called encore purposes. And that really applies to people beyond the point where their first career or maybe their lifelong career has come to an end. And of course, it's essential at all times in life to keep some purpose going. The way a lot of people do it successfully is to, in some way, build on something that they've learned to do or cared about doing in the past, but now it's not in the context of an organization or a paid job, but it could well be something that still contributes to society and or other people. It doesn't have to be that. Some people reconstruct their identity in terms of some avocation they've had. Maybe they like to tell stories, and so they do that with their family, with their friends. Maybe they like to sing or paint pictures. So there's a lot of ways that people can either transform what they're doing and create a new dimension to their identity, or keep it going in some other form. If you've been a teacher, for example, and you no longer work for the school that you worked for because you've retired, well, you can still tutor young people. You can still volunteer and do that. So I would say, number one, the most direct way is to build on the skills and capacities that you develop, but adapt them creatively to your new situation. And number two, you can also develop either new skills or skills that you haven't really had time to work on in your life because you've been busy, like arts or something like that, and develop that into something that is a new dimension of yourself, or maybe not new, but a dimension of yourself that you haven't had a chance yet to fully enact.
So I just read your new book, and the catalyst for your new book, A Round of Golf with My Father, was a phone call. What happened and how did that lead to you conducting a life review?
Right. Well, the backstory on that is I grew up without a father. He disappeared from my life at birth, and I never really knew what happened to him. My mother always told me he was, quote, missing in World War II. I assumed when I was young that meant he was killed. Later, I did find out he was still alive, but I knew nothing about his whereabouts, what he did in life. I assumed he just drifted away and abandoning us, basically. My daughter, who at that time was in her 30s, I had just turned 60-ish, got curious about the grandfather she never met. And being a young person savvy with the internet and everything, she dug up information about him and called me one day and said, you know, Dad, I hope I'm not going to upset you, but I think you can handle this. I wasn't sure I should tell you this. And she then opened up the secret for me in my life of what happened to my father after he abandoned my mother and me. And it was startling, and it was a revelation. And it did, late as it was in my life, being in my 60s, it did transform my sense of self, where I came from, what my ancestors were like, in a way that turned out to be very positive, even though it was very emotional.
And before that call, what was your understanding of the story? You had what your mother told you and other family members, but what was you in your head, what was the version of the story that you told yourself?
I told myself this was a no-account scoundrel who didn't come back from the war and probably drifted away with some, maybe picked up somebody or whatever. And he was nobody I wanted to identify with. As a young man, when I discovered that he was still alive, I said to myself, you know, I don't need a negative role model. I'm trying to figure out who I am. And there's a power to father-son identifications that I was aware of. I, after all, was studying psychology and developmental psychology. So I basically avoided all clues about him or any information about him that ever passed my way. And for most of my life, I wanted to have nothing to do with him, know nothing about him. And by the time my daughter called me and made the discovery, he had died. So I never had a chance to meet him. But as I said, I found out through the information my daughter gave me and then through my own research, that triggered a 5-year research project of my own to find out everything I could about the guy. And I found out he was quite a significant person who had an admirable career. He developed responsibility, which he did not have when he abandoned my mother and me, but he developed it in very significant ways and contributed to the war effort, was actually kind of a heroic witness in a very high stakes trial, and had a significant career as a foreign service officer and raised a second family. And this was the kicker. Two of his daughters, his two daughters, who are very much alive and interesting, I've developed close relationships with as my half-sisters. And I have a couple of cousins that are the sons of my father's younger sister, who was still alive. And I became close with all of them. So I actually ended up with a number of family benefits by the uncovering of the secrets, as well as information about who my father was.
And there were some parallels you discovered about his life and characteristics in yours at the same point in your development. And people would be interested to hear your reflections on this.
Yeah, well, part of my research was I went back to dig up his old school records and dug up my own school records. One of the amazing things I found out was that he went to the same school, independent school I went to, Phillips Academy, Andover, and I never would have ended up there. I grew up in less than privileged circumstances in Brockton, Massachusetts, but obviously my mother knew about this place because of my father, and she sent me there. I never knew he went there, but after I found out, when I did my research, I dug up his records, and it turned out there are some ways that he was very different. I was very responsible. I was a good student. I couldn't believe I was in such a privileged place, and so I figured I needed to deserve it, and I worked hard. He came from a much more privileged background and was irresponsible and lazy, ended up not doing well at the school at all. But we did have some common characteristics that might even be genetic. It turned out he was very gregarious and had a good sense of humor and a lot of friends. And when I went back to my records, I found out teachers said the same basic things about me. We were both kind of messy in our rooms and not very neat. And we had similar comments about that and a bunch of things like that. So there were some commonalities, I think, possibly due to genetic issues and some differences due to different conditions that we were raised under. Namely, he was raised in a very stable, well-off family, and I was raised by a single mother because he abandoned us in a very unprivileged circumstance. So I worked a lot harder than he did in school.
So a five-year research project, what was the biggest surprise among many that you learned?
Well, there was a surprise about him. As I said, I discovered that he was ordered to testify when he was in Europe to the Litchfield trials, which was a very high-stakes war crimes trial that Eisenhower ordered him to testify at. Initial reason, he didn't come back. And he was courageous, and I dug up his testimony, and it was very admirable. And that pleased me, that I found things to admire about him. I also found out that he was a great golfer, and that's the reason for the title of my book, A Round of Golf with My Father. I never had the round of golf, of course. It was an imaginary round of golf. But it was symbolic of my whole effort to find things about him that I could admire and respect and find some way to bond with him in some way. So I think that was the biggest surprise about him. I think for myself, I was surprised that ended up that I could handle all of this very emotional material. And I had avoided that for most of my life, which is why I never followed up on any clues that I heard about him. But I learned that when I did uncover it all, with all of the, there were a lot of sad issues, including the fact that I never could meet him because he was dead. And also my sadness about my mother's condition. She was left in a very difficult condition, and she was also dead at the time. So I was sad I never discussed this with her or had a chance to sympathize with her. So there was a lot of sadness in this quest, but I learned that not only could I handle it, that I benefited from it. I could still grow as a person. And that was, to me, a very pleasant surprise that I could learn. I could learn from my mistakes. And even late in life, I could find ways to keep growing. And I think that's one of the messages of the book, that if you can do this all through life, no matter how old you are, this keeps you flourishing in life. It's a very beneficial way to approach even very difficult challenges.
Your daughter was right. You could handle it.
It turns out that she was right. Yeah.
So what are some other things that you learned about yourself?
Well, first of all, I learned that I, maybe like a lot of people, I am prone to the mistake of avoiding difficult emotional conversations with people. And that to me is important because not because my parents are still alive, they're not, but of course I have children and grandchildren and friends. And I've learned that it's really important while I'm still alive to have the important conversations with people and be honest and let them know everything is important to them because I'm not going to be here forever. And a lot of these conversations are not easy. I know the conversation I would have had with my mother would have been incredibly difficult about why she kept the secret from me all those years and what she really went through. But it would have been better for our relationship, and I think consoling for her and certainly important for my growth to know about this and have that conversation. So I do not want to make that mistake with my children and grandchildren and other people I love, my wife as well. And so I learned that I have maybe this common human tendency that I need to fight, which is avoid uncomfortable and difficult interpersonal conversation. And I also learned that as I said before, that I have the capacity to grow and even late in my life, and that I enjoy that kind of no pain, no gain. Sometimes working through things that are difficult, you end up on the other side of them feeling really, really good about them. And that's an important learning experience for people to have.
So you mentioned golf before, and I'll ask this as a non-golfer. The photo on your book cover is one of your father and his golf swing. What did that teach you in golf and in life?
Yes, it was a wonderful picture that was sent to me by a woman who is my father's contemporary. She was the wife of his closest colleague in the United States Information Agency, which is where he served as a diplomat. And she sent me a picture of him playing golf in Thailand, where he was stationed in 1955. So this was a picture from 1955 of my father taking a golf swing. And if any of your listeners are golfers, they will understand the importance of this. This is the picture on the cover of the book. He was looking down after he took the swing. In other words, he kept his head down. And that's easier said than done. That's the number one rule of golf, which is keep your eye on the ball, don't lift your head up. And it's not only isn't it easy to do, but the way he did it was so sublime that I could tell he was a great golfer just by looking at it. And my golf lesson from him, and I will say just as background, that one of the first things I felt resentment about when I found out all this information about my father was, how come this guy never came by and taught me golf? Because I love the game. And all of my resentments focused on that one. It sounds like a trivial thing because it's only a game after all, but that's the way psychology works. This was the canary in the coal mine that revealed to me that I actually had these resentments and I had denied this all those years. And it all came out initially around golf. How come this guy could never teach me golf? So I wrote in my book that when I got a hold of this picture and I saw him looking down after he took this swing, which was the number one rule of golf, that was the one and only one lesson that he ever gave me. And he gave it to me, of course, not in person through this picture that was sent, but I have learned to do that in golf. Since I saw the picture, I paid attention to that and my game has improved by a couple of strokes a game. So I guess I'm grateful to him and the woman that sent me the picture. And that was my golf lesson. My broader lesson that I learned through that whole emblematic golf experience, because it is symbolic, and that's why I called the book A Round of Golf with My Father. What I learned was that I did have these resentments. I had denied that all these years. I had always said, I didn't have a father, but I'm okay with it. I've had a good run in life. I overcame it. I learned how to do things on my own. I learned how to stick up for myself. Who cares? I did just as well without him. And the fact is that I learned that, yeah, I would have liked to have had a relationship with the guy. And I did miss that. And I learned to admit that to myself. And as I said, it all came out in the form of my golf resentment, but then I forced myself to understand that it was more broad as a resentment. There are a lot of things that fathers do teach young people that I missed out on and I had to do for myself. And it would have been great to have a real life father. And so I learned that. And part of getting past it was admitting that to myself. And so the resentments were no longer buried. And because of that, because they were out in the open, it was much easier for me to get past them the way I had done in the past, which was to try to repress them and deny them.
The benefit of really labeling those even after all those years.
Exactly.
So there's also a lot in the book about your mother raised you as a single parent. And there are a number of lessons you talk about that you learned from her story. I'm curious, what did you take away from her second act career that she built in the 1960s?
Yeah, of course, she had to support herself because she was left penniless without a husband. And she initially went into advertising. This was in the 1950s. And it was, if you've ever seen the series Mad Men, it was that kind of world with hard-drinking men who bossed everybody around. But she was tough. And I think that's one thing I learned from her. She was a tough, determined person who, even if she wasn't treated right, she just kept going. And eventually, she stood her ground, and she was smart, and she was successful in the advertising career. And then, beyond that, and this was the part that I really admired and learned from, she built that. She began by advertising clothes and shoes and that kind of thing. And then she decided to go out on her own and design shoes and design clothes. And so she built on her own strength. She knew about herself that she always was artistically inclined. She loved art and painting. And this was a way of doing applied art in the fashion industry. And she just kept going. She was practical. She always was sure to earn a living and get a paycheck because she had a son to support, and I appreciate that. But she did it step by step. She came into her own until finally, when I was off in college, she went up to, located up in Maine, started a little business with French-Canadian women that's created the clothes that my mother designed, sweaters and socks and scarves with great wool, sold them to L.L. Bean, and had a successful little business and really became herself. And you talk about identity. She really, I think at that point, knew who she was. And I said in my book, I did a life review for her. The book is about doing life reviews in order to establish late in life the most positive identity you can. And I did a life review for her, which basically came to the conclusion that she became the person that she wanted to be all those years, after all those years of struggle. And so I admired that, and I think she was a good model for me in a lot of ways.
So a life review is not a casual undertaking. As you mentioned, in your case, 5 years. And there's research and science behind it. Could you share a little bit about how a life review works for those listening who might want to do one?
Yes, and I do want to give credit to Robert Butler, who, the life review is not my invention. It was invented by Robert Butler, one of the most famous psychiatrists that ever lived, the first director of the National Institute of Aging. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book, and he coined the term ageism, actually. So this is his creation. He's died in 2007, so I kind of resuscitated it. But the idea is, and to borrow a line from the famous Johnny Mercer lyric, accentuate the positive. You go back over your life, and you think of, not randomly and not nostalgically, not dwelling on all of the things that went wrong or the mistakes you made, but you think of the things that you've accomplished, including possibly overcoming some very difficult circumstances, or if you made mistakes, doing your best to recover from them. And the idea that you've done your best, and you think about that, and you think about the things that you were proud of, the things that you were purposeful about. So it's a lot about purpose, which, of course, is the work that I've done about how people develop and continue with purpose over the years. So it's very connected with my work on purpose. But you think about your history of purposes, really, in life, and bringing that forward to the present. And I will say, to continue with the Johnny Mercer lyric, which goes, accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, and don't mess with mystery in between. I think that's a great song lyric, but the idea of eliminating the negative is not necessary. In fact, the idea is you should actually confront the negative, but you do it in a positive way. For example, I learned to do about actually admitting to myself that, yeah, I have resentments about not having grown up with a father. But I tried to think of the ways that I compensated for that and the ways that in some ways my life has worked out just fine without that, and that I've learned from the difficult things and I've overcome them. And so I don't gloss over the fact that there was negatives. I don't eliminate them, but I try to give the most positive spin I can on them, because you want to end up with a positive identity in the end of the life. That's the purpose of the life review, is to give you a sense of what Eric Erickson called ego integrity, a sense of positivity, and you own your life in a sense. You feel that this is the life that you were given, and you made the best of it, and you still have more of it. I mean, that's the other thing. We're still alive, and whether we have 5 years left or 10 years left or whatever we have left, that's great. Let's make the most of it. Go forward. And so life review is not just about the past. It's also about the present and the future.
Point jumped out off the pages in your book that it's, you think it's looking backward, but it's not the whole story. It's really spinning it forward.
Yeah.
And how you can apply it in the moment as well.
Yeah. I also quote Faulkner in the book, who famously wrote, "The past is not dead. It is not even past." And that's kind of the point of the book also, which is the past is, if you think about it in the right way, it's very much part of our present, and it can give us, it's a treasure house of strengths that we can use going forward to the future. If you use the past in the right way, it can help you forge a very positive, creative, hopeful, thriving future.
You mentioned all the work you've done on purpose, and I know you had a construct geared toward earlier in life, dreamers, dabblers, drifters.
Right.
And in the work I do, part of the work I do is helping people create their new life after retirement or leaving the full-time work, world of full-time work. And I'm wondering how those things just might be applicable to this stage of life and your thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, just in a sentence, not everybody is fully purposeful. Being fully purposeful, as I mentioned earlier, means really committing yourself in action to some long-term goal that goes beyond the self. And most people finally get there, but certainly not a significant number of people never manage to do that. But they may have components of it. They may have the dream, and that's what we call them. They may have a vision of what they want to accomplish, but they've never gotten around to doing much about it. So we kind of call those people the dreamers. And you see a lot of young people like that. You know, they want to be the next Steven Spielberg or something and make movies, but they've never actually made one. So that's one way of only having a partial purpose. Another way is by kind of being a dilettante, having a lot of things you do, and your life is full of activity. And again, you see a lot of bright young people like this, that they're building up their resume for college, and they're doing 1,000 things, but they don't care that much about any of them, and they haven't committed to any of them. So those are people that often we call the dabblers. And then there are drifters who never even have either a dream or any activity at all. But if you have a dream or if you have a lot of activity, you can build on that and become more purposeful. And so people at any age, if you have a vision, you really care about something, you care about, let's say, I really care about the problem of homelessness or all those people on the street, and you really care about it, you can find ways to do something. Volunteer at a soup kitchen or make a little contribution or write to your congressman or woman about helping the homeless or doing something. So you can get active and do more than the dream. And that can happen at any age. And if you have a lot of activities, but none of them are that meaningful to you, you can think about focusing and really developing a commitment and understanding why that activity is important to you as a person. So that's another message of my book, is that we are all still growing. As long as the brain is alive, it can learn and grow. And we can become more fully purposeful. And I do believe the more fully purposeful we are, the more fulfilled our lives are.
Here's a question I've never asked before on this podcast. Could you share with us the question you once asked His Holiness the Dalai Lama?
Yes. I was fortunate the Dalai Lama invited me to do a dialogue with him on the opening of his North American Center up in Vancouver. And that's an amazing experience where the invited guest, who is me, presents, and he was interested in my work on purpose and how purpose develops. And the ritual is, I made the presentation, which was about 20 minutes, and he gets to ask you one question, and you get to ask him one question. So that was, I thought a lot about the question. And the question was, and this is something that, Joe, you and I just talked about, the people who we found, and there's about a quarter of the population at any age, is just drifting. So they have no components of purpose at all. They don't have anything they really care about that much in terms of goals, and they're not doing much about anything that's important. And that's a significant number of people. And we find that at every age, 20 to 25%. So I asked the Dalai Lama, and these people are very hard to communicate to because they don't have goals and they don't care about them. So I asked him, well, how do you encourage people like this to develop some components of purpose? Because it would help them and help the world if they cared about something productive to do that was contributing to the world. And so he said, he gave me an answer, which I translated into kind of a bit of a stick and a carrot approach, although that was not his words by any means. But basically what he said is, you tell them stories that you have to, and you have to tell them stories that illustrate two things, and you have to do them both. If you do one without the other, it's not going to work. You have to tell them stories about how joyful it is, how people find joy in doing things that are meaningful and that they're proud of. And so you give them examples, you give them human living examples of people that have found in their lives something to dedicate themselves to that's brought them a lot of joy. And he said, in addition to that, you also need to tell stories about how empty and depressing a life without meaning is. That if you just drift, if you're just a hedonist and you devote your life to nothing more than pleasure, or if you're just drifting through life discouraged and unconfident, it's not a happy way to live. And so tell stories about that too. So he said, do both the positive and the negative. And that's how you can get people to move off the dime and to begin filling their lives with something that they believe in and that they can devote themselves to.
Reminds me of A Christmas Carol.
Oh, good. You know, I never made it. Excellent. Thank you for that. That's terrific.
It's a great visual, but
that would be a good story to tell people. That's great. Thanks, Joe. That's nice.
So what advice would you offer people listening who'd like to do a life review?
Well, I think number one would be to do it in your own way. I don't have a cookbook recipe because I don't believe in a cookbook recipe. Everybody's life is totally individual and everybody is a snowflake, really. And so everyone has their own things that they're proud of, their own issues that I'm sure that they would like to confront, and you know, their own people in their lives and their own history about, do you go back and look at school records? Do you have military records? Do you have parents that you knew or didn't know? What were your ancestors like? So everyone has their own life. And so you have to do it in your own way. It's like telling a story about your life. I would say, you know, take a look at some thoughtful memoirs of people that have done this. Obviously, would encourage people to look at my book, A Round of Golf with My Father, because I did one in my own way. That's the Bill Damon way of doing it, but for Bill Damon's life, not for anybody else's life. But it might give you ideas or it's set a model. And there are other very nice, there are a lot of other memoirs, including ones by other psychologists. Howard Gardner has a memoir out. Sherry Turkle has a memoir out. And all of these have elements of a life review. So I would say, take a look at some examples, do it in your own way. And as I said before, accentuate the positive, because that's what you're trying to do. You're not trying to be just nostalgic or discouraged or feeling bad about your life. You're trying to find a way to feel that your life was as well lived as possible, given the hands you were dealt in life. And nobody, believe me, nobody has a perfect life. There is no human being that hasn't made tons of mistakes. That does not exist. There is no human being that hasn't had some catastrophe or tragedies in their life or with people they love and care about. So, you know, we all have things in our life that were difficult. But the point is that we've had a life and we were given a life. And so make the most of it and try to think about it in in a way that's positive and fulfilling.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, the book, and a lot of wisdom on purpose and life review. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joe. It's delightful talking to you, and you've got a great show. So really, it's a privilege to be on your program with you.
Thanks again. Appreciate it.
So let's compare notes. I have three takeaways I'll share, and the first one is about purpose. You don't have to be a hero. As Bill Damon shared, really, purpose is about something that's important to you. It's about something that makes a difference in the lives of others, something makes the world better beyond yourself. But it doesn't have to be something gargantuan. And I see in my work in coaching people that purpose is one of those words and topics that can paralyze your thoughts because we think it needs to be lofty or gargantuan. But it really needs to be something practical and day-to-day that you care about that makes a difference to others. So rethink purpose and define your new purpose or purposes. Could be a multi-purpose retirement you're headed for. What works for you? Takeaway two, develop a new dimension of yourself. I spoke quite a bit about the idea of an encore career, an encore purpose, and that you have a chance to take what you're doing, what you've done in your career, what you're passionate about, what you're skilled at, and redeploy it. Could be something adjacent, could be something new, but it's a chance to bring something to life that's in you that you haven't fully brought to life before. So rethink how you can develop a new dimension of yourself, perhaps in service of others, but a new part that you know is there that you want to express more fully. And third, think about a life review. And if you undertake it, keep in mind his definition, which is a great one. It's a history of your purposes. But I also think he made a good point about do it in your own way. There are a number of resources, starting with his book, that will help you learn what it's like to organize and do a life review, but do it in a way that works for you. And keep in mind that it's not really just about looking backward. That's a key part of it. But it's also about things that are relevant to where you are now. And most importantly, it can help shape your future and where you're heading. You'll find more information on William Damon and his book and other resources in the show notes. And keep an eye out for our next episode. It's the third in a series of retirement roundtables where I have the pleasure of inviting back some of our previous guests to talk with one another about topics relative to your future and your retirement. Thanks for listening.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.